Welcome, this is Divine. Welcome to episode 491 of the Divine Intervention Podcast. In today's podcast, we're going to be discussing the USMLE Step 2 CK Step 3 Rapid Review. This is going to be series 106. Let's get right to it. So what if they give you a question about a 19-year-old female? And you're told that she's being treated for Hodgkin's lymphoma. And then you're given a bunch of labs. You know, you're told that she has not been feeling well for the last 24 hours. And given a bunch of labs, you notice the potassium is 6, which is high. You notice that her phosphate is extremely high. You notice that creatinine is like 3.5 or something crazy like that. If you see something like this, what should you be thinking about? I really hope you're saying, oh, Divine, this sounds an awful lot like tumor lysis syndrome. So how do people get this problem? And how do we get these labs? Well, the thing is, usually we're going to see this in the context, in a classic context of a person having a malignancy, usually some kind of hematologic malignancy, because those things are usually pretty sensitive to the therapies that we give. Well, not all of them, but many of them. And as those cells die, stuff is going to spill out into the circulation, right? So, you know, for example, potassium spills out into the circulation because remember, potassium is an intracellular ion, so they're going to get hyperkalemia. Your cells are pretty rich in phosphate, right? Many cells use ATP. As they explode, they release all that phosphate into the bloodstream. And that phosphate, what do you think phosphate likes to go after in the bloodstream? It loves to go after calcium. So it's going to bind up your calcium. You're going to have hypocalcemia. And then think about it. Also, all these nucleotides and whatnot, you're going to spill them off into your bloodstream. And then this fancy enzyme, xanthine oxidase, is going to convert it to uric acid. So you're going to have hyperuricemia. Honestly, this stuff I just discussed is extremely high yield. This is something that is an easy arrow question on your exam. So make sure you know these classic electrolyte issues that you'd find in a person with tumor lysis syndrome. They're going to have high potassium. And I've explained the mechanism behind pretty much all of it. Like the renal failure, they get it because uric acid is not great for the kidneys. It's kind of simple, par for the course. So they're going to have high potassium. I've explained why. They're going to have high uric acid. I've explained why. They're going to have high phosphate. I've explained why. They're going to have renal failure. I've explained why. They're going to have low calcium. I've explained why. Make sure you understand. Again, that's the thing. In this Anki generation we live in, please, I'm not saying don't do Anki. I'm just saying do Anki, but also make sure you understand what you're Anki in. So, again, typically we tend to see this, again, with a lot of hematologic malignancies. Although, honestly, you can pretty much see this with any malignancy, right? But it's just way more common on the USMLEs in people that have, like, aggressive lymphomas, hematologic malignancies. You can also see something kind of similar in a person that has rhabdomyolysis. Just somewhat similar concept because muscles, right, have a ton of ATP. They have a ton of potassium in them. So that's why many times if people have hypokalemia, for example, they become like they have weak muscles. Potassium is super vital for a muscle. So if a person has rhabdomyolysis for any cause, right, let's say you've been running a marathon or you have a crush injury, or you took a bunch of ecstasy and you were dancing at a party for a long time, or say, for example, you're taking a statin or you're taking a fibrate, right? Especially a statin. All these things are pretty myotoxic. They can cause problems. Again, notice all the different ways they can lead into this tumor lysis-like concept, right? But again, you're going to see the same electrolyte anomalies whenever so many cells die, right? Hyperkalemia, hyperuricemia, hypocalcemia, high phosphate, renal failure, stuff like that. So how do you manage tumor lysis syndrome? Well, on the USMLE exams, you're going to try to correct these abnormalities, right? Like they can really go, that's the thing about tumor lysis syndrome. It's a topic that is easy pickings for multi-system processes and disorders. And many people always wonder, what exactly do they test with multi-systems processes and disorders on the USMLEs? Well, this is an example of a topic like that. Basically, if there's a topic that cuts across like so many different disciplines, it's going to be under multi-systems processes and disorders. I mean, literally, look at the name, multi-systems processes and disorders, processes. If something has a lot of like processes that can play into it, it's going to be part of this section of the exam, right? So you're going to try to correct these electrolyte problems. Like, for example, they can give you an EKG in this person showing tall peaked T waves. Well, you're like, oh no, this is hyperkalemia kind of shining through. Well, obviously you're going to give calcium gluconate first to stabilize the myocardium, so those people don't die of a dangerous arrhythmia, right? So you're going to try to correct all the electrolyte problems, right? But if they're asking you, what is the first thing you should do? If a person, like, first thing you should do in a tumor lysis syndrome, fluids. Load them up with as much normal saline as you can, so you can achieve a vigorous diuresis, right? As you give them all that fluid, it's going to wash through their kidneys and wash away those nasty things. And then those people should also consider allopurinol. Allopurinol is a xanthine oxidase inhibitor, so it's going to prevent the production of uric acid, so those people's kidneys don't keep not working well. And remember, if you don't see allopurinol as an answer, you may see febuxostat as an answer. Febuxostat. That's another xanthine oxidase inhibitor. FEBUXOSTAT. Febuxostat. It has XO in the name. That can help you remember that it's a xanthine oxidase inhibitor. Alternatively, on your exams, you can use a drug like rasburicase or pegloticase. Those are uricase analogs. What is their job? Their job is to literally convert uric acid, which is not very soluble, to allantoin, which is very soluble. Birds express this uricase enzyme, right? So pharmaceutical companies figured out a way to kind of make it and use it in a drug. It's just that they're pretty expensive. That's kind of the problem. Okay. Now, what if they give you a question about a patient and they tell you that this patient is a 65-year-old male and he comes in with, over the last 2 days, he has been having progressively worsening back pain, and you're told that he has a little muscle weakness, he has had many urinary accidents over the last 24 hours, and you're told that, oh, this person has a previous history of lung cancer, stage one lung cancer that was put into remission with chemotherapy. When you see something like this, honestly, you want to think about this person having some kind of spinal cord compression. Whenever they want to give you a spinal cord compression question, they can kind of manifest it in many different ways, right? So they can bring it with, back pain. You're going to see a back, and they're usually going to give you some kind of cancer history, or they give you some antecedent in the question that tells you that, yeah, this person is kind of like a cancer candidate, right? So you're going to see back pain, you're going to see a little muscle weakness, you'll have like cardiac Wiener style symptoms. You'll see saddle anesthesia, loss of bowel and bladder control, right? And honestly, for these people, if you're trying to think of a diagnostic test for your exam, you want to go ahead and get an MRI. MRI is pretty much the best study you can use in a person that has spinal cord compression. So what are you going to do in a person that has spinal cord compression? Again, the thing is kind of important to understand what you do acutely versus what you're going to do over time. That's one thing that's lost on many people preparing for the USMLEs. They know all the treatments for a disease, but they don't know what you're supposed to do acutely. Like, many diseases have a particular acute treatment and a particular chronic treatment. Many people don't break these things up, right? Like, many times people get lupus questions wrong, or rheumatoid arthritis questions wrong, because they don't have this kind of concepts down, right? So when a person has spinal cord compression, the first thing you're supposed to do is to give IV steroids, right? You're literally supposed to give IV steroids, especially dexamethasone. Dexamethasone is pretty amazing for this purpose, right? But another thing you can do, right? So you've done the dexamethasone. That's always what you should do first. But after that, say, for example, they tell you in the Q-stem that dexamethasone has already been given. What are we going to try? Well, the thing is, you can try many other things, right? So for example, you can try radiation. Radiation, many times when people have like spinal involvement of malignancies, radiotherapy is usually going to be the smart thing that you're going to try. Radiotherapy is usually the smart thing you're going to try. Although sometimes you can get surgery. You can get like a neurosurgical whatever thing. But many times radiotherapy is kind of a big thing there. Now, what are the cancers that can cause this, right? Like the classic ones, prostate cancer in men, breast cancer in women. But don't sleep on some other malignancies that can honestly cause this problem, right? Things like multiple myeloma. Multiple myeloma can cause spinal cord compression. I know it may not be something that you're used to seeing from many resources, and then you see it on your exam, and then your eyes pop open, right? So they can absolutely test spinal cord compression with multiple myeloma. They can test spinal cord compression on lymphomas, right? Believe it or not, there are certain leukemias and lymphomas that love to go after the spine. That's why, in fact, in certain malignancies, if I'm not mistaken, I'm pretty sure they do this with some of these childhood cancers, like ALL. Many times they're going to give intrathecal methotrexate because these things can go to a person's spinal cord and cause problems, right? You want to make sure you get all the cancer, right? So you're not just going to say, let's give you chemo in your bloodstream. No, we're going to also give you chemo in your spinal column, actually. So don't be surprised if they throw this with lymphomas, they throw this with multiple myelomas, right? They throw this even with lung cancer. I kid you not, as we're saying this question, lung cancer can certainly spread to the spinal cord. Okay, just kind of keep that in mind. Again, the USMLEs these days, many people think that they are testing so many new concepts. No, it's not new concepts they are necessarily testing. Yes, don't get me wrong, there are some new things they're kind of throwing in there. But there are some old things that they test. They just test it in a somewhat novel way, just to see if people can really still extend that thought process. Because if all you've memorized from your Anki deck is prostate cancer, breast cancer causes spinal cord mets, then you're gonna have a lot of problems with questions like these. That's why, again, it's understanding the construct, understanding the concept that matters the most, right? Understand the concept that really matters the most. In fact, I want to maybe talk about another thing that may kind of help a person here. Another situation where they do this novel business is with SVC syndrome, right? Superior vena cava syndrome. Pretty much everyone, when they see SVC syndrome, the only cancer they think about for SVC syndrome is lung cancer. And don't get me wrong, many times on your exams, is lung cancer going to be the cause of SVC syndrome? Absolutely. But what is another interesting way our friends at the MDMEs can test SVC syndrome? They can test it in a person that has lymphoma, especially lymphoma that's very aggressive, lymphoma that's very, malignant. That can cause SVC syndrome. That's something you actually want to keep at the back of your mind for exams, right? Because, again, what is the construct? What's the concept of SVC syndrome? The concept of SVC syndrome is that your superior vena cava is literally encased by something. That's the concept. Whatever does the encasing can be different for many people. It can be lung cancer that does the encasing. It can be lymphoma that does the encasing. So just kind of keep that in mind, especially when you see SVC syndrome-like symptoms in a younger person, especially a person that has not smoked. Malignant lymphoma is probably going to be the cause you're going to be looking out for on your exams, right? Malignant lymphoma is probably the cause you're going to be looking out for on your exams. And again, how does SVC syndrome present? Basically, everything in the head and neck will be swollen for the most part, at least, on physical exam, right? So you're going to see their face is going to be swollen, their neck is going to be swollen, right? And you may wonder, like, Divine, why are all these things swollen? Well, it makes sense. Here's the thing. I think of the heart as an organ that receives drainage from two big pipes. One big pipe is the superior vena cava. That pipe drains the upper parts of your body, right? Like your face, your neck, your upper extremities, for the most part, and parts of your trunk, But the IVC is the pipe for the lower parts of the body, right? So like your abdomen, liver, some parts of your esophagus, your lower extremities, right? The IVC is the pipe for those. So if you have a tumor that's obstructing the SVC pipe, then all the stuff that drains into it, they're going to get clogged. As those things get clogged, you're going to run into a bunch of problems. So your face is going to be swollen. Your neck is going to be swollen. Sometimes these people, they'll have GVD, right? So again, it's not only like cardiac tamponade or heart failure that causes GVD. SVC syndrome can also cause GVD. Why? Because your jugular veins literally drain ultimately into the superior vena cava, right? And believe it or not, really, there are so many ways they can go after this. Sometimes you can even give you a chest x-ray, right? And you can see a widened mediastinum, right? Again, in this particular rapid review series, I'm trying to show you like some unusual ways they kind of go after some concepts that are like real legit ways that It could be tested, right? That is beyond the classic thing you know. They can literally give you a widened mediastinum, right? Again, folks, widened mediastinum doesn't always mean aortic dissection. Widened mediastinum doesn't always mean pulmonary anthrax. No, widened mediastinum can also include SVC syndrome. It can also include SVC syndrome. Just kind of keep that at the back of your mind as you're studying for your exams, right? So again, you're going to see SVC syndrome, lung cancer patient, person that has smoked, right? Or a person that again has a nasty lymphoma. So what are we going to do for this person that has SVC syndrome? Well, the way we're going to fix their problem is we're going to radiate. You're going to radiate. But if you don't see radiotherapy as an answer, you want to try to basically just do something to control the malignancy. Bring it under control. Shrink the tumor somewhat, right? And also, don't forget that people that have SVC syndrome, besides the classic stuff like radiotherapy or trying to control the malignancy, you can also use diuretics to help these people out. You can use diuretics to help these people out. And elevating the head of the bed is not a bad idea. Elevating the head of the bed is not a bad idea. I can totally see our friends at the MBMEs kind of throwing out a question on SVC syndrome, and the right answer is elevating the head of the bed, right? So again, just kind of keep this at the back of your mind as you're studying for your exams, right? Keep this at the back of your mind as you're studying for your exams. So I guess let's maybe go ahead and discuss another topic. So what if they give you a question about a patient and they tell you that, you know, this guy is a 75-year-old guy and, you know, for the past 2-3 weeks, he has noticed some red tinges in his stool. And he has, you're told that over the past month, he has lost like 7 pounds or some, you know, amount of weight. And then you get some labs, you notice his MCV is 65. His hematocrit is like 24% or something really low. So then you're asked, you know, for the primary disorder in this question, what is the most likely organ of metastasis? Well, I would really hope you're saying liver. Okay, so how did we get there? Let's kind of break this down. So this person clearly has colon cancer, right? At least that'll be the most common thing, right? You see like GI bleeding, older person, it's probably going to be colon and weight loss. It's probably going to be colon cancer, right? It's probably going to be colon cancer. So colon cancer, it's kind of a high yield topic to know these days for the exam, for many reasons, right? Not just for exam reasons, but honestly, if you're a physician, pretty much in almost any discipline you do, you kind of want to make sure you can recognize a colon cancer. It's just something that presents in a lot of old people. But it also presents a lot in a lot of younger people. Like you hear all these crazy stories these days of people in their 20s, in their 30s, stage 4 colon cancer, dying from it, right? I imagine it's kind of like a dietary thing going on there. But there's also going to be genetic causes, right? There are many genetic causes of colon cancer, like FAP, familial adenomatous polyposis, or person having Lynch syndrome. You know, Lynch syndrome is also associated with colon cancers. I always think of Lynch syndrome as being associated with the CEO malignancy. You know, think of like chief executive officer of a company. So like colon cancer, endometrial cancer, ovarian cancer, right? People that have Lynch syndrome tend to get those problems, right? So how did we know that this was a colon cancer? Well, it's an old person losing weight, blood mixed with their stools, right? And you see that they have very likely iron deficiency anemia, right? You saw the MCV was less than 80, so it was a microcytic anemia. We saw that the hemoglobin was low, right? The most common cause of microcytic anemia is iron deficiency anemia. Remember, the other causes of microcytic anemia is like lead poisoning. Anemia of chronic disease sometimes can also be microcytic. And also thalassemia also causes microcytic anemia. Okay. But that's not the main point of discussion today. So this person has colon cancer, right? And where does colon cancer love to go to? It loves to go to the liver, which makes sense. Think about it. Your colon, a lot of your colon drains into the inferior or superior mesenteric veins, right? So since a lot of your colon drains into the inferior superior mesenteric veins, believe it or not, those things ultimately drain into the hepatic vein. And as they drain into the hepatic vein, it's going to ultimately drain into the IVC, right? So it's going to drain the portal vein, then hepatic vein, then IVC, right? And then, you know, so because it kind of goes around the liver a lot, you're going to potentially see this person having a liver mets, right? So that's going to be the most common area of metastasis for a person that has colorectal cancer, right? You know, colon cancer, typically, if you suspect that a person has colon cancer, you're going to do some kind of colonoscopy. And when you do the colonoscopy, you're going to see the lesion, you're going to get a tissue biopsy, right? Because getting that tissue biopsy is kind of helpful for helping you decide what kind of therapy you're going to do, right? And usually, people are going to get some kind of CT scan of the abdomen as well, right? So again, let's kind of talk about colon cancer workup. You're going to start off with a colonoscopy for the most part on your exams, right? If you're kind of worried about it, get a colonoscopy, then get a CT scan of the abdomen and pelvis, right? Just to see like whatever meds they may have, right? And typically when people have colon cancer, they're going to get a bunch of therapies. They're going to get surgery, right? They're going to get surgery of some sort. And then they're also going to get chemotherapy. You don't need to worry about the chemotherapeutic regimen, at least not for the step two, step three level. That's something if you're kind of going to some of these more, you know, there are certain residencies that kind of worry about this stuff, right? So like, especially the internal medicine folks, yeah, you're probably going to worry about this stuff quite a bit. So, you know, these people tend to get a bunch of chemotherapeutic drugs. 5-FU is kind of a big one. And I guess maybe let me throw in a small factoid with 5-FU, right? 5-FU, remember, it inhibits thymidylate synthase. I just kind of figured I would talk about it because it's one of these drugs that they love to test on step two, step three. Again, every now and then they just toss some pharmacology on these exams. And it's usually going to be like some common drug, you know? Again, don't get me wrong, can they go for an obscure drug? Yeah, but honestly, especially for step three, it's going to be most of these common drugs that people have just kind of forgotten once they, you know, cross that boundary from med school. In fact, I'm going to give some quick advice, a life lesson based on that point at the end of today's podcast. So don't run away. It's actually going to be pretty good advice for people that are going to be taking these exams in the future. I'll make that a life lesson at the end. But, you know, don't forget 5-FU. How does it work? 5-FU works by inhibiting the enzyme thymidylate synthase. When you inhibit thymidylate synthase, then you can prevent the conversion of deoxyuridine monophosphates to deoxythymidine monophosphate. And that's going to be very helpful for these folks, right? So again, we say colon cancer, they're going to get surgery almost always. They're going to be on chemotherapy for sure, right? And then again, you got to deal with the liver problem, right? So the thing is, if they just have like a simple met to the liver, right? A simple met. So you see, I use the word met, just one liver lesion. I just cut out the liver lesion and that's it. But if they have like many lesions in the liver, that's not good news, right? That's basically if you see like multiple liver mets, right? Mets, so multiple, right? Mets. Multiple, right? You see multiple meds, that's not good. Those people don't have they're probably not going to do very well, unfortunately. So just kind of keep that at the back of your mind as you're studying for your exams. Keep that back of your mind as you're studying for your exams. Okay. And again, this is a step two, step three rapid review. So I'm not going to talk about the step one related things here. We're not really going to go into that. So I think I should go ahead and stop here. This has gone on for almost 25 minutes now. I like to keep these rapid reviews short, so it's something you can listen to when you have like a small bite of time or whatever. So, again, I offer review courses for all the USMLE exams. The courses I offer, I have a course for step one specifically, is a 25-hour course. It's actually coming up pretty soon. It's coming up like in the second week of January. It's for step one or people taking step two, step three that have like awful step one foundations. And then I have a step two class. I have a 20-hour step two, step three class. I actually have one coming up in December. It's coming up, I believe, in the third week in December. All these courses over Zoom. And then, you know, I have a 100-hour step two, step three school is taking place next year. It's a huge, massive time commitment, but it's like an extremely, extremely comprehensive class. Again, I've made separate podcasts on these things, so you can kind of check them out on your own time. And then for step one to step three, I offer a 2.5-hour test-taking strategies class for the MBA means. I offer a 4-hour biostats class. I have a 5-hour social sciences and ethics class. Again, all these classes over Zoom. If you're interested, shoot me an email. I'll give you some more information. And also, these classes are not lectures, right? So if you're expecting lectures, then you certainly should not be attending these classes. These classes are almost exclusively all scenarios. scenarios. And these scenarios are very helpful because one, it kind of sets your brain in an exam-taking mindset, but also shows you how the information will be tested. And again, I'm not just going to be throwing facts at you. I'm going to be discussing pathophys. If you've listened to my podcast, you understand how I teach. That's how I teach. And we also devote a lot of time for questions. About 1/6 of the total course time is spent answering people's questions. So again, and these classes are over Zoom, so you can attend them from literally anywhere in the world. And then I have a bunch of helpful charts that people use for last minute review as well before the exam. So I offer those courses, and then I have these podcasts on the major apps, Apple, Google, Spotify. I have a YouTube channel, Divine Intervention, USMLE Podcasts and Videos. And then I also have another website called Divine Intervention, lifelessons.com. Many people emailed me that, wow, Divine, I love your life lessons. So I figured I'll make another website, Divine Intervention, lifelessons.com. There's actually an Apple podcast associated with it called the Divine Intervention, Life Lessons Podcast. And many people, from a biblical perspective, I try to put like 2 podcasts a week. I believe we have like 231 episodes right now, actually. So let's go to the life lesson I have, right? So this life lesson all kind of came from this thing I said on the fact that, wait, see, if you're taking step 3, you notice that every now and then they usually just present like the common drugs on the exams, right? But the thing is, most people, once they cross that boundary from med school to residency, and they've forgotten all these things, even things like vancomycin, they're like, man, how does vancomycin work again, right? I know you may say, oh, Divine, there's no way I will always remember how vancomycin works. Until you start residency and you're like, wait, vanc what, right? So here's the thing people don't recognize. It's amazing, and I've seen this so many times, it's amazing how profound knowledge atrophy kicks in when you're not in consistent review mode. This is something that happens a lot with residents. You see like all the stuff, these may be people that even got 270s on their step 2, and now they just have absolutely like very little knowledge, right? So what's the life lesson here? The life lesson here is, if you want to keep, actually there are 2 life lessons here. If you want to keep something in your mind, you need to keep using it in some way. That's the truth. You want to keep something in your mind, you need to keep using it in some way. Either you're teaching it, or you're thinking it, or you're reviewing it, or something in some way, shape, or form. But another thing I want to say is, it's always important to get things done as early as possible. In fact, that's probably the main life lesson here. Be an early doer, right? You can do something, you know, 1 of 2 times. You can do it early, or you can do it late. The thing is, when you do something late, you're probably not going to do it as well, and you're going to suffer while you're doing that thing. You're going to put in way more effort while you're doing that thing, right? Many people wait. I've seen this problem so many times. You see people, they wait until their second year of residency or their third year of residency to take step 3. By then, they've forgotten everything they learned in med school, or at least a good chunk of it. They've forgotten a lot of it, and then they now have to sweat, suffer, struggle as they are prepping for step 3. They are putting in way more time than is necessary, because they've just forgotten everything. So it's almost like they're learning all these things fresh, straight up, right? Don't leave till tomorrow what you can do today, right? Don't leave till your second year of residency what you can do in your first year of residency, right? I've literally seen this story play out so many times. You see people, they take step 3, they keep failing it in residency. And then after they failed it enough times, the program is then like, you know what, we're going to kick you out. And then they get kicked out of residency. And then think about it. Imagine how horrible that is. You've put in all this work, studied for all these USMLEs. And then just because of something that is an almost like easily avoidable problem, you get kicked out of residency, right? So don't be that kind of person, right? Or you go under the radar of your program director. Or you then start going to some clinical competency committee or some whatever committee that they have all these CCC, but they just put all these committees in residency, right? So you don't want to be under those things, because I know it may sound like I'm blabbing, but I promise you this stuff is kind of important for your future. When you go under the spotlight in residency is usually not a good thing. I'm going to tell you that right now. Residency is one of those places where you don't want people in your business, right? Once you go under the spotlight, oh my goodness, you're going to be in so much, you're not going to, basically like when staff and faculty, they are looking at you as a person that failed an exam. Every little thing you do that normally they would overlook, it becomes heavily magnified. heavily magnified. Heavily magnified. Right? So like if, for example, oh wow, something that most other residents do and it's not a big deal, for you that has failed the USMLE exam, a step 3 exam in residency, it becomes a big deal because they start thinking that you made that mistake because your knowledge base was awful. Again, you may say, Divine, why are you prognosticating on this? I promise you this stuff, I hope that you're not in a bad situation where you have to remember this advice in the future, right? But just do things early. Like I remember for me, once I graduated from med school, I graduated in like May, I took my step 3 in July of that same year. Just get it out of the way so you don't have to worry about it again. And the thing is, why does it make sense to take... In fact, honestly, I'm almost going to make a podcast on when to take step 3. I think it'll be a smart podcast to make. I just think it's going to help a lot of people. Because here's the thing. When you start residency, people have very few expectations of you. They almost feel like, ah, this person is a fresh newborn resident. They don't know their left from their right in the hospital. So if you make mistakes, people just chalk it up to, ah, he doesn't know better or she doesn't know better, right? So that's a good time to study for and take step 3 when people are still treating you with a lot of benefit of doubt. But as you go along in residency, you become a second year, third year, they kind of expect you to know a lot, right? So at that point, and you have more responsibilities, you're responsible for more. You have all these juniors you got to deal with, right? You have all these med students you got to cater to. So if at that point you're kind of struggling, right, and you don't have all this time to study, then that increases your risk of failing the exam. So honestly, I don't want you to be in this situation. So please, like, whatever you can do, if you know that, man, there's something I can just do today and get it over with, just get it done, right? Like you see residents, they have all these modules they're supposed to complete. Yes, are these modules and things annoying? Yeah, they're annoying, right? But then you put a time limit on it, right? And then you wait till the last minute or you don't get it done. And then the program director gets angry at you. And as they get angry at you, you're wondering, why are they getting angry at me? Well, you could have just done the right thing. Don't put yourself on anyone's radar. Don't put yourself on anyone's radar, right? So, in fact, I think this podcast, honestly, as I'm saying this life lesson, I'm going to stop here. But I think I'm going to do a podcast on residency etiquette. Residency etiquette, I think, is one of these things that's actually going to help a pretty large number of people. So that'll be a future podcast, God willing, and we'll see where that takes. Okay, so thank you for listening to me today. Again, my apologies for kind of rambling at the end. But I promise you, this advice is so important. I don't know. I've just seen too many cases. I see so many of these every single year because people reach out to me all the time. I've seen so many cases of this every single year. You see some resident, for some ridiculous reason, they start getting in trouble with their program, right? You don't have to be in this situation if you just kind of play your cards right. So until next time, bye for now. God bless you.